So, good evening, everyone, and welcome. So this is the fourth of our series of Dharma seminars on practices for nurturing connection. And it's fine to just come in partway along if you haven't been here for the previous ones. We are getting them up online if you want to catch up on the website. It's deeply ironic that in an age of relentless electronic connectivity, so many people feel disconnected and isolated from the world, from others, from themselves. Or at least that's what I seem to hear and observe sometimes. That's a question, you know, that I want to actually talk about in a Dharma talk this Sunday. What is connection in a world of limitless connectivity? What's authentic anymore? That questioning is partly what prompted us to take up this theme for Wednesday nights and look at connection. We're all pretty well acquainted with the mind states that foster separation, disconnection, fear, anger, distrust, envy, even desire and craving are states of separation, because we want that outside of us. So we thought we'd look at states that foster connection. And so far we've talked about gratitude, trust, and last week Michael talked about generosity. And the take-home practice that he gave, for those of you who are here, was giving intangible things. It came from the haiku of the famous Japanese poet Ryokan, who wrote something like the thief who came and stole my robe. I wish I could have given him the moon, as he looks out from his empty hut. So we talked about making a practice of offering something beautiful, something, even if we don't say it to another person, even mentally to say, you know, I give you this, or to in some way non-verbally, even you know, walking with a friend, just stop and give the gift of noticing birdsong, or simply to turn off the cell phones and have tea with each other and give each other the gift of your full attention, uninterrupted. Did anybody try a little of that? I know one or two did. Any comments? It's a good practice. And of course, there are many other ways that we can be generous. And one way is with our caring. And tonight we're going to talk about empathy, our caring and compassion. If you've been here for the previous you've probably already begun to notice how these different practices and states interrelate and support each other. So today's topic, empathy, is related to the others. In a way, we could say that empathy forms the basis of the basis for our awareness of connection with other beings. And hence, for our capacity to respond to other beings with compassion. Empathy, most simply, is the experience of feeling the experience of feeling another being's experience as our own. Another's feelings as our own. It comes from the Greek empatheia, which means in passion or feeling into. And it refers to an emotional capacity. But dictionary definitions seem a little bit muddled about how it actually functions. We have an old battered 1976 Oxford Concise. I looked in it, and it says, "The power of projecting one's personality into and so fully comprehending the object of contemplation." I thought, wow, that's really out of date. I don't think that is quite how we would put it these days. Fully comprehending is certainly an overstatement. It begs the question of how exactly we do that. Well, in 1976, mirror neurons had yet to be discovered. How many of you have heard of mirror neurons? Yeah, several of you have. You've all probably experienced seeing someone else trip or jump in surprise and flinching or startling yourself. We've all done that, right? Maybe you've even felt a twitch between your shoulders seeing an eagle lift off from a branch into the air. And you've probably felt tears well up when someone else weeps, especially in the darkness of a movie theater when your inhibitions are lowered. We feel the ache of our friend's grief and the uplift of their joy. Yawning is contagious. Apparently, if you catch someone else, the more you are susceptible to catching yawns, the more capacity for empathy you have. I don't know who studied that, how they measured it, but I read that. And laughter is contagious too, right? Smiling is contagious. This is because we are born equipped with mirror neurons, which resonate when we see physical behaviors in others. And the more we do, the more these neural pathways are strengthened. It starts when we're born. Even newborn babies begin to respond to and mirror the facial expressions of their mother or primary caregiver. And these physical mirroring functions are believed to form the basis for emotional attunement. They link up gradually with our cognitive functions as well. As the child develops what's called theory of mind, the ability to imagine their perspective and feelings and thoughts of another being. These capacities are innate, but they need to be exercised and neural pathways formed and reinforced again and again for us to function to our full potential. These capacities allow us to read accurately another person's state of mind and heart. These are complex body, brain, and mind processes that really only rather recently have been researched and better understood. There's a pretty easily accessible explanation in a book called Buddha's Brain, which I will have in the kitchen if you want to look at it afterwards, and a much more technical and in-depth but very readable section of a book called The Neuroscience of Human Relationships, which is quite fascinating. Also, I'll have it in the back. But the important point is that though empathy is our birthright, it's necessary for our survival as social animals. It can only be fully developed in this dance of close relationship, this give and take. Young children who have been raised in relationally impoverished environments, like orphanages or in families suffering from often multi-generational addiction, trauma, or neglect, these children may not develop the capacity to relate to others with empathy or to read others accurately. We have to receive empathy to be able to respond with empathy, to learn empathy. The good news is that although our early childhood experiences are powerful in shaping us, our brains actually have the ability to grow new and form new neural pathways well into adulthood. So we can learn empathy and compassion. But it's harder as adults. It takes commitment, takes attentiveness, and being willing to miss the mark and forgive ourselves and each other over and over again. When it comes to nourishing the roots of empathy, the earlier the better. Even 18-month-old babies, when they have been treated with empathy themselves, will respond to another child's distress by handing it a toy or going to get an adult to help. Has anyone ever heard of a program called Roots of Empathy? Yeah? Yeah. It was started by Mary Gordon, who's a Canadian woman, started in Ontario, and it's spread throughout Canada and starting to reach internationally as well, particularly in Australia. It's a program, it's a school program. It's structured around monthly visits to an elementary classroom by a baby. And it's mother and sometimes father, sometimes both parents come together. Most often it's mother, but sometimes fathers come too, and that's very interesting. Or father and baby alone. And they come once a month over the course of a school year. The baby is placed on a blanket in the middle of the circle, and the students sit around the circle, and with a parent nearby. And the children watch and observe closely the baby and its interactions with the mother, and they interact with the baby as well. Each session, the sessions are facilitated by a trained Roots of Empathy instructor, and each visit is preceded by a session where they talk about what they think they're going to see in the baby this time and discuss, prepare for the visit, and then there's a debriefing session the week after the baby visits where they discuss how the baby developed, what they observed, and what emotions they observed the baby express. Why did she cry? Was she hungry or tired? Or was she frustrated because she couldn't crawl to reach a toy? And this evokes and sparks discussion amongst the children, perhaps of their own experience of frustration, trying to learn, failing, and then finally succeeding. So it's a program designed to teach emotional literacy. Mary Gordon says, through observations of the baby's emotions, children learn about their own emotions and the emotions of others. They learn to take the perspective of another, understand the power of resolving conflict that lies in being able to see a situation and the world from another person's viewpoint. The baby comes predisposed to love and expect the best from everyone in his sphere. He has no inhibitions or wiles to disguise how he is feeling and what he needs. He is a pure representation of what it is to be human and how to interact empathically with other humans. Here is where the roots of empathy begin. I'm going to read you a little story that she tells. She says, Darren was the oldest child I ever saw in a Roots of Empathy class, mostly at their younger grades. First, grade 1 through 3 are the most common classes, but sometimes older grades as well. He was in grade 8 and had been held back twice. He was 2 years older than everyone else and already starting to grow a beard. I knew his story. His mother had been murdered in front of his eyes when he was 4 years old, and he had lived in a succession of foster homes ever since. Darren looked menacing because he wanted us to know he was tough. His head was shaved except for a ponytail at the top, and he had a tattoo on the back of his head. The instructor of the Roots of Empathy program was explaining to the class about differences in temperament that day. She invited the young mother who was visiting the class with Evan, her 6-month-old baby, to share her thoughts about her baby's temperament. Joining in the discussion, the mother told the class how Evan liked to face outwards when he was in the snuggly and didn't want to cuddle into her, and how she would have preferred to have a more cuddly baby. As the class ended, the mother asked if anyone wanted to try on the snuggly. Do you all know what snugglies are? The baby carriers, and most often small babies, face the chest. If anyone wanted to try the snuggly, which was green and trimmed with pink brocade, to everyone's surprise, Darren offered to try it. And as the other students scrambled to get ready for lunch, he strapped it on. Then he asked if he could put Evan in. The mother was a little apprehensive, but she handed him the baby, and he put Evan in, facing his chest. The wise little baby snuggled right in, and Darren took him into a quiet corner and rocked back and forth with the baby in his arms for several minutes. Finally, he came back to where the mother and the Roots of Empathy instructor were waiting, and he asked, "If nobody has ever loved you, do you think you could still be a good father?" Over and over, she would observe babies reaching out to the very child in the class who was withdrawn and difficult. She calls it the wise baby syndrome. It's quite a mystery. You know, these are 6-month-old babies, or up to a year. But we know that animals, you know, horses, dogs, a couple of cats I've had, have this nonverbal resonance, a capacity for something very much like what we call compassion. Children who go through this Roots of Empathy program have been shown to have increased emotional awareness, reduced levels of bullying, and improved capacity for reasoning and learning. So it turns out emotional intelligence and cognitive development go hand in hand. They're not two separate things. And contemporary neuroscience is validating this. About 5 years ago, I visited a friend of mine in New Brunswick, in the Maritimes, who is the principal, or was, she's retired now, principal of a very small town elementary school. And she is a trained Roots of Empathy instructor herself. And I got to be there for their closing ceremony the last day the baby came. And they all write their wishes on a card to give the baby. And it was really a delight to see how bonded these children were to their class baby. So I thought I'd just read you a couple of some of the messages. This is from her book, that children would wish for the baby. They would give their wishes to the baby the last day. "My wish for Silas is peace, food, life, toys, freedom, house, rest, good clothes, water that is clean, clean air." Grade 2. "Courtney, here's my wish for you. Forgive your own mistakes." Grade 4. "I wish that Madeline would smile forever and never stop smiling. Her smile would cheer up the world." Grade 6. "Tristan, I wish that your daddy is still... Tristan, I wish that your family is still all together and that you don't lose your daddy. My daddy died." Grade 1. "I was telling a friend about this program." She hadn't heard of it. A few days ago, Michael was there. And we decided there should be remedial Roots of Empathy groups for adults. having each of us take a turn on the blanket in the middle might be a little much. But there are other ways. There are other ways that adults can learn about empathy and its complexities. Empathy is not simply identifying with another person's inner state as our own. Through our empathic capacity of bodily, emotional, and cognitive resonance, we form a hypothesis of how the other feels and thinks. It's an educated guess. We don't know for sure. And this is, as I said, called theory of mind, the ability to put oneself in another's shoes. And even toddlers begin to do this. But as I mentioned, this development can be impeded or damaged. Trauma, abuse, or neglect can take a toll, and children can grow into adults who chronically misinterpret the emotions of others and see threats and danger where none exist, often striking out to protect themselves. And maybe in more subtle ways, we all do this. We get it wrong sometimes. We think we know how the other person feels. We second guess, and sometimes we get it wrong. We misgauge a friend's intent, or we take our partner's inattentiveness as a personal affront. Most of us could use some remedial work when it comes to empathy. In the title essay of this book called The Empathy Exams by Leslie Jameson, she writes about her experience working as a medical actor. You know what a medical actor is? A medical actor plays a role in training medical students. They enact a person who is ill in some way, and the medical student practices interviewing to diagnose them. So she would receive a detailed description of a character that she would be playing, and the person's symptoms and family situation, a lot of detail. And she would also get kind of cues as to what she should reveal easily and what she should hold back and make the medical student work for it or ask appropriate and empathetic questions. After each 15-minute encounter, they only got 15 minutes. You know, that's how much time. Doctors are lucky to get 15 minutes these days with their patients. After each time, she would then fill out an evaluation checklist. Item 31 was voiced empathy for my situation / problem. It wasn't enough for the student to express empathy in their manner and tone. They actually had to voice it. So I'd like to read you her comment on this mode of evaluation, or what she, from her own experience doing this. She says, empathy isn't just measured by checklist item 31, voiced empathy for my situation / problem, but by every item that gauges how thoroughly my experience has been imagined. Empathy isn't just remembering to say, that must be really bad. It's figuring out how to bring difficulty into the light so it can be seen at all. Empathy isn't just listening, it's asking the questions whose answers need to be listened to. Empathy requires inquiry as much as imagination. Empathy requires knowing you know nothing. Empathy means acknowledging a horizon of context that extends perpetually beyond what you can see. Empathy means realizing no trauma has discrete edges. Trauma bleeds out of wounds and across boundaries. Sadness may become a seizure. That was one of her roles. She had to play a woman who had had severe losses and started having seizures with no organic cause. Empathy demands another kind of porousness in response. So for our empathy to be authentic and for us to be able to respond to others' pain, we need to allow a kind of porousness between self and other, while simultaneously maintaining impeccable self-awareness, so that our empathy does not become identification or fusion. We can't reach out a helping hand or even bear compassionate witness to another's pain if we are overwhelmed or wallowing in pain ourselves. If we get down into that quicksand or muck, we can't offer a steadiness. We have to have one foot solidly solidly placed, at least. We need to hold at once, at the same time, what Buddhist thought calls the two truths, the relative and the absolute, the particular and oneness. So at the same time as there's no separation between self and other, we remain particular individuals. Jameson points out the importance of empathy that's grounded in confidence and courage, because she's observed how her own empathy has often been contaminated by fear that other people's problems would happen to her, or that people will stop loving her if she didn't make their problems her own. Noticing that way that sort of self-interest contaminates ever so slightly or distorts ever so slightly is really important. So she talks about bringing intention to the practice of empathy. She says, empathy isn't just something that happens to us, a meteor shower of synapses firing across the brain. It's also a choice we make, a choice to pay attention, to extend ourselves. It's made of exertion, that doubtier cousin of impulse. Sometimes we care for another because we know we should, or because it's asked for, but this doesn't mean our caring is hollow. The act of choosing simply means we've committed ourselves to a set of behaviors greater than the sum of our individual inclinations. I will listen to his sadness even when I'm deep in my own. That's a deliberate choice. To say going through the motions, this isn't reduction so much as acknowledgement of effort, the labor, the motions, the dance of getting inside another person's state of heart or mind. This confession of effort chafes against the notion that empathy should always rise unbidden, that genuine means the same thing as unwilled, that intentionality is the enemy of love. But I believe in intention, and I believe in work. I believe in waking up in the middle of the night and packing our bags and leaving our worst selves for our better ones. So I think, you know, she's being quite rigorous here and saying, you know, although empathy is natural to us, don't expect it to just always arise easily. That we have, we can choose to align ourselves instead of turning away, which is so easy to do. our practice asks us, I said the two perspectives of the relative and the absolute that we hold simultaneously, there are two other ways, two other perspectives, maybe they relate to that, and they're compassion and wisdom. You could say wisdom is the absolute, perspective of what's called emptiness or boundlessness, and compassion is the response of the heart to the specific situation, the specific of suffering that's right before us. And wisdom and compassion are called the two wings of our practice. You know, without both wings, we can't fly strongly, we can't steer our course. Compassion gives us an open heart that allows us to feel the suffering of others and respond with appropriate means. And wisdom gives us a spacious, flexible mind that sees deeply into the impermanent and conditioned nature of existence. So with both of those perspectives, we can speak and act coming from empathy, but without a personal agenda and with great patience and understanding. I'm going to cut out a little part that I might say a little bit more about at the end, but I'm going to close here and ask you to pass out some paper and pens. Michael, can you help pass around just to make it go a little faster? And what I'm going to ask you to do, you can go ahead and start as soon as you get your implements, is to make two lists. Make a list of people, could be individuals or categories, or doesn't have to be humans, beings, for whom you find it quite easy to feel empathy. And then make another list of beings for whom it's, you know, you find it more challenging to feel empathy. Just see what comes to mind.